Music from Keith and Kristen Getty, When Trials Come. Before that, Chris Rice, his song Breakfast Table. 14 and a half minutes after the hour. It's a Tuesday morning, and joining us now from Glenshaw, Pennsylvania, is the Reverend Dr. John Delancey. John, we haven't had a chance to talk to you in a few weeks. Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
All right. He's got John, for those of you who don't know, is a pastor there in Glenshaw, which is in the Pittsburgh vicinity, and conducts tours multiple times a year over in Israel. And John's tours have kind of an archaeological bent, kind of that slant, and he's just a tremendous teacher, and we're privileged to have him with us today. Really good article over at Christianity Today. This popped up to our attention a couple of weeks ago, but they've summarized the top 10 archaeological finds in Israel in the year 2013. It's kind of that end of the year thing, and this is the second year they've done this, and I really would love to have your opinion on some of these things. Some of these things are just fascinating, and I know you've seen the article. There's some pictures involved, and when this conversation goes up on the website as a podcast, we will have a link to the article so everybody can take a look at that. It's over at ChristianityToday.com. What do you think of these 10 selections, John?
I think they're right on target. Every year, there's always something that is found in Israel that is either very interesting, either it brings new light into what archaeologists had found prior to this, but most importantly, these are finds in part that help us confirm the historicity of the Bible. So that's why I'm sort of excited about being on today and sharing at least a few insights on at least some of these top 10 finds.
Now, most of these connect most directly with the Old Testament, don't they?
They do. In fact, the first one that's listed was found at what is now known as the second alternative site for the biblical city of Ai, or Ai in Hebrew, city mentioned in Joshua 7 and 8. An Egyptian scarab was actually found, and why it's significant is that it was found in a level of the excavation that seems to put it into the late Bronze period, at the very time when Joshua, according to the Bible, was coming through and conquering 31 cities, according to Joshua 12.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's significant about a scarab? What is it, and what does it mean to the Egyptians?
Well, this tells us that the Egyptians did have some influence here, certainly as, for instance, I think it's the fifth important find of 2013. A sphinx was found at Hazor. That sort of tells us that Israel was the land between in this ancient geopolitical battle for the region. And this particular scarab, typically found, of course, in Egypt, was found here in that place on this site where it seems to give evidence that there was actually people living here at this time. The question is, where is Ai? Well, the first one that was found by a guy named Calloway, back in the 60s, didn't have any evidence of Joshua being here. But this one seems to help confirm, if you will, that indeed, this may have been the city that was destroyed in the Joshua 7 and 8.
Was the scarab a religious symbol? I mean, it's a beetle. And in fact, in the recent mummy movies, you see scarabs portrayed doing all kinds of evil things and eating up people and stuff. But this must have been, was it a religious symbol? Was it representative of a god in Egypt?
Certainly, it's found all the time in Egypt.
So it is commonly associated with them then, so, yeah.
Yeah, it was symbolically sacred to the Egyptians, and they were known from, even from the Old Kingdom, even through the first intermediate period, and were significant in terms of what they represented. They were ornamental, they were commemorative in some regards, but they were always associated with some kind of symbol of life or tied to an Egyptian pharaoh or official in some way. They were representative of dignitaries as well.
Okay. Well, this was just a 3/4-inch long amulet. It could have been left there by anybody, I suppose, not necessarily indicating of and by itself that the Egyptians were present in the area at the time. This would be just north of Jerusalem. So interesting. What's next on the list?
What's next on the list is a wine press from Jezreel. Jezreel, of course, is the name of the valley. The largest valley, it's called the Emek in Hebrew. But the 1 Kings 21 story tells us about evil queen Jezebel, who, of course, met her death here in Jezreel. She and her husband were the ones who tried to eliminate Naboth and convert his vineyard into a garden for the king's palace.
King Ahab, yeah.
Yeah, Ahab. But this was a site where it's not really an impressive rounded tail site, but it's interesting to know that a wine press from that time period was found, which sort of gives us the hint that this was a significant site and certainly the sort of the hometown for Ahab and his Phoenician wife, Jezebel.
Are grapes grown there today in that region?
Not necessarily in that region. They're, of course, grown up north. They're grown in the Shvelah. Okay. But not necessarily known for its vineyards. Jezreel Valley is more agricultural in terms of wheat and barley.
Okay. Well, it would suggest that at one time, then, wine must have been an important industry there.
Yeah, such as like the third find that was listed as significant. It was a wine cellar. And excavators pulled 40 wine jars from a storage room. Now, I'm not sure if you guys are big wine drinkers, but if you are not, even like I am not, this was quite impressive because when we take a look at Isaiah 5, for instance, I think it gives us the impression that whoever owned a vineyard in biblical history were considered prominent in that society.
So, oh, yeah, that anybody with 40 wine jars is going to be, you know, your upper crust or collectors. Yeah, there's a friend of mine who has a wine cellar that stores 5,000 bottles. Wow. I'm not going to say I've got a long history of wine drinking and wine tasting and that sort of thing, but my one of my email addresses is Wine Dude.
Good for you.
I go back a ways. I used to write for a magazine for beer and wine and that sort of stuff.
Interesting.
And occasionally I had to drink some.
Well, you know, the very word wine had a double meaning in Israel back then, and it really means happiness. Wine is symbolic of happiness. And so no surprise that it would have been important at all. But I imagine those jugs, the wine jars, were pretty well dry. And what kind of wine did they make that back then? Did historians know? Archaeologists know?
I'm not sure what the fermenting process was that would make it any difference.
I'm thinking they were generally sweet red wines, is what I understand.
Yeah, there we find wine presses all the time from Roman days, but this particular find dates to the 18th century BC. So this is pre-Joshua. This is what makes this so interesting. It now is the oldest and largest wine cellar found in a Canaanite palace. So these Canaanite guys were really living it up, I guess, prior to
they would have been in the wine business before Israel was even established then.
Exactly, yeah. So the fourth find is a royal public building at Kirbeth Kayafa. It's this site located in the Ela Valley. Why is it significant? Is because it really gives some credibility to the idea that King David indeed did have some kind of heavily fortified Judean fortress here overlooking the Ela Valley, just right near where, for instance, guys like Goliath, the Philistine, lived. And to find impressive storehouses and a royal building, for instance, surrounded with a wall just 20 miles from Jerusalem, this tells us that David, no doubt, had secured this area, this particular valley, in the context of the Philistines being so close by.
Now, this reminds me, this whole idea of fortified cities kind of makes me think of the American frontier and U.S. Army outposts on the edge of civilization there. And much the same reasons, because David would go and fortify a city for lots of different reasons, but security was a huge issue for the people who produced in the area and for travelers who went through the area. And it was a way of staking your claim, wasn't it?
It was. But for David to construct something as significant as this, that far from Jerusalem, tells us that he saw the importance of trying to contain the Philistines, who, according to Scripture, three or four times would come up the Rephaim Valley to try to attack Jerusalem. Well, this particular fortress was probably built to eliminate that movement, if you will. Mm-hmm. And what makes it also important is that it causes us to reevaluate the positioning of the Philistine army in that 1 Samuel 17 story, where David, of course, as a young boy then, was the one who killed Goliath in the context of this valley.
And he would have been very familiar with this area geographically. I mean, he would have been there.
He would have, he would have been familiar with the importance of this particular western approach to Jerusalem. Mm.
The next one you mentioned already in passing, but to me this one really caught my imagination, the Sphinx of Hatzor. Tell us about that.
Well, according to the archaeologist, the front paws of a Sphinx was found this past summer. And what's significant is it had the name of a pharaoh after whom the third pyramid was named. So this particular Sphinx dates to about 1,000 years even before the Exodus. Hmm. And to find something this old, and yet the Egyptian presence and influence in places like Hatzor and later on in Beit Shan.
Now, Hatzor is well north of Jerusalem. That's north of Galilee, isn't it?
That's north of the Sea of Galilee. So the Egyptian presence here certainly seems to indicate the importance of this particular city holding geopolitically the area in securing it, for instance, from invaders from the north. Mm-hmm. So to find something that, like this is quite amazing, particularly with that name on it. Of course, the statue fragment was found in a destruction layer that dated to the 13th century, which is the time period of the judges. But nonetheless, it's quite interesting to find something of an Egyptian influence here.
Now, what is it about a Sphinx? Was it just a common design motif for the Egyptians, or did the big Sphinx in Egypt, you know, set a standard of some kind? Did it become a symbol of Egypt? Why do you suppose they would have replicated a Sphinx pattern in Hatzor?
Well,
speculation, I know, but
yeah, I guess my best guess would be to because the Egyptians associated this type of symbol with deity. You know, the pharaoh himself was viewed as a god, and certainly the Sphinx was something that helped them symbolically to recall the significance of a leader like the pharaoh. I think this is probably, especially with the inscription of this pharaoh's name on it, probably was meant to remind them of their own religious system and belief, because of course the Egyptians believed in a number of gods, and unlike of course the Israelites, who were monotheistic, the Canaanites as well were polytheistic as well. But I think it's quite interesting to find something of Egyptian influence here in a Canaanite city.
Gold found near the Temple Mount. What's the significance of that?
Well, this does not date to the biblical times. It dates to the Byzantine time or late Roman time. But it tells us that the later Christians, of course, after Constantine in the 4th century, these late Romans were primarily Christian. And, of course, to find something of significance like this so close to the temple meant that the Christians somehow probably regained some control of Jerusalem before, of course, the Muslims came in roughly 7th century, 630 or so, and, of course, would build eventually the dome there in
690, 691, yeah. I think, something like that. It was finished, yeah.
But a lot of gold. I don't know how much that would be worth now, but to find 36 gold coins, along with some gold and silver jewelry, dating to, you know, this 5th, 6th, even 7th century AD, is quite significant.
Well, there were turbulent times back then. As I was mentioning to you just before we went on the air, I'm rereading that Michener novel, The Source, and he talks about this whole time period in depth. Of course, he covers thousands of years of history in his novels, but it's amazing what that culture was like, what that place was like in the 7th century. What a dangerous place it was for almost everybody. I mean, constant warfare, it seems. Number 7, Roman Legion Base in Galilee.
Yeah, the Roman Legion. Of course, we know of the 10th Roman Legion that was used for the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. This seems to indicate the prominence of the 6th Roman Legion that primarily was used to control this area in Israel for the first two or three centuries after Christ. But the site is between Megiddo, which of course is well known for its Old Testament ruins, but this particular evidence of the Roman Legion base in Galilee seems to indicate the widespread influence of even Roman, how can I say it, Roman presence.
No,
even,
occupation, yeah.
Occupation even in this time, even in the later centuries after the time of Christ.
Yeah, this story makes a mention of the use of satellite photography and ground-penetrating radar. Those are going to be two great tools for archaeologists these days because, as you've explained to us in sessions past, how a till is basically a heap of past civilizations, and you dig down to get to the older levels, and, of course, going back further and further in time. So just about everything of importance, especially with respect to biblical archaeology, is well underground, and we're talking, what, 20, 30, 40 feet underground even? The rubble of the successive civilizations and cities on these sites, does it get that?
Oh, certainly it can go that deep, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how far radar can penetrate the ground, but certainly was used here to identify these finds. It's interesting that ceramic tiles were found in Caesarea along the coast that in about, that was the city that was built about 18 BC by Herod. But it suggests that the legion was, even at that time, based in Judah. And, of course, the 10th legion, as we know, was used in later years to destroy Jerusalem.
And, of course, Herod served at the pleasure of the Romans. So yeah, that's no great surprise. Number 8 on the list, Mount Zion Priestly Mansion.
Yeah, this is interesting because when we walk past outside the Zion Gate today down to the Dung Gate, you can actually see this excavation. It's blocked off. It's has some gates and fences around it. But this seems to tell us that perhaps this was maybe occupied by a family of temple priests. There's a traditional location for the house of Caiaphas, for instance. He was the high priest who played a significant role in handing over Jesus to the Romans, of course, as you know from the Gospels. But I think that site does not lend itself with any archaeological evidence that would support the story, but this particular find seems to indicate that maybe the priests lived closer, just west of what we call the Western Wall today, and to find a mansion from the time of Christ, well-preserved lower levels of this home, certainly is revealing of a prominent family living at the time of the first century.
Yeah, including a bathroom, it says here.
Including a bathroom, yeah.
Indoor plumbing, well, we would presume. I don't know. Priests and Levites, they were really, by that time, two separate entities, weren't they? The priestly folks were part of the temple business, part of the empire, the corporate workings of the temple, and probably had money. Levites, not necessarily so. Would that be correct?
Yeah, that's a correct assumption. Levites were certainly used in the context of worship.
And there were thousands of them to help with the work at the temple. But the priestly few apparently lived in the lap of luxury. At least that's, by this indication, that would be
that
so.
And that was one reason why the Essenes were so distraught with what was happening in Jerusalem. Of course, they would leave and establish their own community. But the Sadducees and the Pharisees, Sadducees who ruled the temple precincts and the Pharisees who were the primary teachers, yeah, it was there were some some corruption, if you will, and a type of, how can I call it, they did not practice what they preached, for instance.
It was my impression is that it's kind of like a mafia family. I mean, they ran the temple for the money in it, the profit in it, exchanging money, selling sacrificial animals, and the baths, the ritual baths before you could go into the temple. It was big business, and that's what irritated Jesus so when he threw out the moneylenders. So
yeah, in this area where this house was found, by the way, there are other mikvahs or mikvot in Hebrew, plural,
ritual baths
were found also. So yeah, they seem to really have a good control of Jerusalem during the first century, and again, to find a house that dates to the time of Christ, perhaps inhabited by a priestly family from Jerusalem, is pretty neat.
Now we go back to the Bronze Age, number 9 on the list of the top 10, an extra destruction level at Gezer. Why is that important?
Well, Gezer is mentioned as a city in Joshua. It was not totally conquered. It was one of the cities that probably for a number of years until the time of Solomon, as the text in 1 Kings tells us. It was not completely destroyed by Joshua, but Canaanites and Israelites probably lived maybe even together, or the Canaanites probably had more control of it until the Pharaoh, of course, destroyed it, as the passage tells us, and gave the city to his daughter.
That's right, yeah. It was kind of the dowry. Wife. Yeah. Now, Gezer then is south and west of Jerusalem?
Yeah, it's in the Shvelah. We actually go to the site. It's not an open site, but when I was there this past summer, there was an excavation team actually digging and revealing this extra layer. So I actually saw this personally and talked to the excavator from a seminary in Texas, actually, in conjunction with Hebrew University. But it's significant because this destruction level dates to around the time when Joshua was here. So it maybe does give us an idea that Joshua tried to take the city, but of course the text in the Old Testament tells us that he was not completely successful.
Now, can they tell whether the destruction was caused by warfare or a fire or an earthquake? Can they distinguish from one kind of destruction to the next?
In some places, of course, of the 31 cities that were destroyed by Joshua, only 3 were burned. But in those cities, Jericho, Ai, of course, we don't, and Hazor up north, at least the 2 of the 3 have a burn level, so you can see that actually quite easily. Mm-hmm. But here, I'm not sure exactly how to comment on that because I'm not sure how much structure was actually found. As in fortification walls here at Gezer. It was dug way about 100 years ago by a guy named McAllister. And but what's impressive about Gezer is the layer of destruction that dates to this time, according to the Bible, where Joshua would have been on the scene.
And incidentally, for listeners, a little later on today, when this article is posted as a link within our podcast, it has links within it that could take you to more detail on some of these findings. So you look forward to reading that. And number 10 on the list, this is fascinating to me, a stone pyramid under the Sea of Galilee. Tell us about that.
Well, I probably don't know much more about it than anyone else, because this was rather, again, new, and not much has been written about it. But they tentatively date it to around 2000 BC or earlier. And I'm not sure exactly what they think it is. It was located in the southern area of the Sea of Galilee, right where the water exits the Sea of Galilee proper into what is called the Lower Jordan Valley. But this was some kind of unique rock formation. And I guess they're just guessing of what significance it played.
That is really old, and I wonder if it speaks to the water level of the Sea of Galilee at the time. It must have been a smaller lake.
Well, I would think it would have been larger, actually, but I'm not sure exactly what they think this is in terms of whether the rocks are positioned in a way that gives any credence or credibility to that they were put there intentionally. I guess I'm at a loss with terms of what it might be, and I think those who found it are calling it a mystery find as well. I'm not sure they know exactly what it is also.
And I don't see a photograph of, but they do have a drawing, a diagram on the attached. Actually, the article comes from the Voice of Russia, which is interesting. So some of those links will be internally in this this article as you take a look at the podcast later today on Broken Road, on the BrokenRoadRadio.com website. Interesting. John, I'm glad you had made time for us today, that we could get you back and take a look at these things. It's always intriguing to see physical evidence, and I think this is one. It's got to be one of the huge attractions for you in going to Israel as often as you do, to hold something in your hands that was held by a person, designed by a person, built and served a purpose back in Bible times, and particularly Old Testament. Fascinating world of archaeology. When are you going back to Israel?
I have a trip in March, and that's filled up with 46 people. It's now closed, of course. Mm-hmm. Greece and Turkey follows that in late March into April, and then April, another Israel trip in June. I'll be digging at the site, and maybe we can speak about that at another point in the future.
And what's
the El Beit Makah up north.
Beit Makah, Now that has something to do with a garden, doesn't it? I connect a garden with that site because we've talked about that in the past.
Yeah, we did talk about it, and it'll be the second season for the dig, and I'm anxious to get back and get my hands dirty again, as they say.
I'll bet you are.
How long has it been since you've been digging, John?
It's been a long time, since 82.
Wow.
But I've been involved with archaeology. I interact with archaeologists, try to keep up with the latest find, especially when we go to sites and see and talk to people and see the excavations. But it'll be good to get back.
Okay. Well, John, it's been like 24 years since you've been digging. So you want to take one of those like low rise beach chairs with you and something to pad your knees and maybe a walking staff to climb back upright again when you get off the ground.
What do you hope to find?
They already found some structure dating to the time of the Israelite period. This was a city that was destroyed by the Assyrians. So I think the main goal of this second season will be to identify the gate area and more fortification walls.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing about that from you when the time is right. John is connected with Biblical Israel Tours, and the website is biblicalisraeltours.com. You can find a lot more about these tours, maybe find a place for yourself in one of the future tours. John Delancey, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate having you back again, and we'll look forward to the next time.
It's good to be with you guys. Take care.
Yeah, we'll do that.
Yeah, good to hear your voice, John.
We'll do that. Back to music on a Broken Road Radio, a Tuesday morning from Anthony Berger. Good morning to you.